Welcome to Season 7 of the Art of Teaching podcast. I'm Matthew Green, and I'm so grateful that you've joined me today. It's wonderful to know that there are teachers across the globe that are finding our episodes useful, so please take the time to subscribe, share the episodes, and leave some feedback. Before we get started, I would like to acknowledge the Darawal speaking people who are the traditional custodians of the land on which I'm recording. I pay respects to the elders past and present of the Darawal Nation and extend that respect to other Aboriginal people that are listening to this. I hope that you get as much out of our discussion as I did. Please enjoy. Today I have a very special episode for you, an interview with Dr. Phil Cummins. He began his career as a history teacher and cricket coach, and now he is an author, researcher, leader and speaker. Phil is an educator by trade and conviction. He has authored over 30 books and an array of other influential publications and research reports, and is acknowledged internationally as an expert in strategy, governance, leadership and Indigenous education. He is also co-host of the Game Changers podcast with Adriano De Prato, which has received over 250,000 episode listens. I hope that you get as much out of this wide-ranging discussion as I did. Please enjoy. Phil, welcome to the podcast. Thanks thanks so much for joining me. Where are you phoning in from?
Matthew, thank you for having me. I am, of course, coming from the People's Democratic Republic of Fitzroy on Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung country, where the oat milk flows in the streets and the silken tofu hangs from the trees.
Fantastic. And that's a really lovely segue to what's your coffee order for when I can finally buy your coffee?
Look, it's about 100 metres from my place in Fitzroy is a cafe called Piney Weiss, and Rose and her crew will make me what's called a triple triple. And so that's three shots of coffee, three sugars, topped up with that silky, silky flat white milk, all in a circle group carrier cup, of course.
Fantastic. Is there an item that's still on your bucket list? Could be personally, professionally.
I taught Greek ancient history for 20 years, and I've never been to Greece.
Wow!
And the problem is, of course, you know, when you really get into something, you need the time to do it properly. So I think when I'm an even older man, when I've got 2 or 3 months, I really want to go to Greece and see everything and crawl all over every temple and go to every set of ruins on every small island and love every second of it.
Yeah.
That and grandchildren. Can't wait for grandchildren. So James and Harper, if you're listening, get on with it. Oliver and Stars, you too.
My daughter is called Harper.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And so is this a sort of a friendly hint to your children to get cracking?
To my daughter-in-law. Yes, my daughter-in-law Harper, who married James earlier this year. Harper is the most delightful human being in the world. I'd hate to put any pressure on her whatsoever, but, you know, hey, grandchildren, that'd be good.
Nice one. Okay. Well, I think that's a parent's job, isn't it, to embarrass their kids? So yeah, I think you've succeeded on that.
I think so. Well, it's revenge for nappies.
Look, I've got a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, I take great pride in embarrassing them. So it's lovely to know that it continues into adulthood.
Excellent.
Can I just ask, Phil, is there a book that you have read, could be personally, professionally, that has caused you to reconsider a few things in your life?
There's a fantastic book by Mark Buchanan called Ubiquity that was released, I think, in 2000. And I'm going to guess 2003, maybe a little later than that. And in it, Mark Buchanan, a little bit like Malcolm Gladwell, Tipping Point was another one of those books. You know, Tipping Point and Ubiquity are both science books written by journalists for non-scientists. Amazing. So in Ubiquity, it helps you to understand the way in which hard science can be used to understand soft science or social science. So particularly things like chaos theory, or in this case, ubiquity theory, helps you to understand the course of history. And in that, helped me, you know, having spent 20 years teaching people causation, to discover suddenly that actually you can, when it comes to things that are sitting at a tipping point, you can predict the rate at which events will occur, and you can predict how many, so the quantity might occur within a particular time period, but you can't predict the sequence of them, and you can't pinpoint exactly where they'll happen in. And so this applies to things like earthquakes, it applies to things like bushfires, it can apply to things like the way in which we understand causation and war. So having spent my life teaching people about the importance of trying to construct a narrative, then to have that all flipped on its head to say, maybe you need to think again about the way in which we relate our story to the broader story of what's going on around us. That, Ubiquity and then again Tipping Point were both fundamental in helping me to understand that my own biases, my own inherent preferences need to be challenged and questioned just as much as anybody's. And if you know anything about our work, the body of our work in Game Changers and the School for Tomorrow, that's what we try and challenge people to do, unrust themselves. Amazing. Get the WD-40 out, apply it to those rusty little gears and levers, and to think again about our understanding of what it is that can and should be done to help take, you know, what we call the big step forward and up.
Yeah, amazing. And on that sort of thread, Phil, what's something that you have changed your mind about? It could be recently, or it could be a longer period ago, but what's something which you have had to apply some of that WD-40 in your own life?
I want to come to something from this year, because why not this year? Not? I think I've always been the sort of person, you know, if you're going to get something done, you go out and get it done yourself, and you look to within your own resources, and you work hard, and you try and make things happen the way that they should happen. I've formed a view this year that we've actually reached a tipping point in our profession, that the structures around which the everyday role of a chalky, of a teacher, have been constructed are no longer doable. So whereas I used to think that we could work smarter and that we could find ways, particularly through collaboration and technology, to make things happen, I actually think now that the demands that we place on the profession and the requirements we have for the way in which we educate students to honour what we would call the new social contract of education, which is today's learning for tomorrow's world, I don't think it's doable anymore. So I think, as I've advised several schools in our consulting practice, thinking about their strategic development, we should be thinking most of all about how to apply the resources that we've got to reconstruct the role of a teacher so that they can actually do what it is they do. Because, you know, Matt, you know more about this than I do. You're at the chalk face every day. You're sitting here doing this on your holidays while, you know, in between times you're trying to make it work. I don't think it's doable anymore. I don't think that we can ask people to do all of the things that we want them to do to achieve the standard we want. We've got good people, by and large, in the profession who are just exhausted now. And that's because they're trying to do the right thing. You know, they're trying to make things happen. You know, I know we've had a federal education minister recently talk about duds in education. I can say with confidence that the duds that were around when I started teaching back in the 1980s, or was it perhaps the 1880s, they're not in the profession anymore, and they haven't been for a very, very long time. We've got good, honest, earnest folk who are trying to make things happen, and they just can't. They can't get everything done. They can't get the basics done without pushing themselves beyond that which is reasonable. So I think as a profession, I think as a society, we need to think and rethink the role of the teacher, and we need to work out what will make it doable. I have a feeling that the only way that we're going to do it in the end is fewer face-to-face hours in the classroom. But then I don't think that's a bad thing either. I mean, you know, you've spoken, you know, Pasi Solberg and his theories on play and so on. He's a, you know, it's why do we give children so much work to do when they're in school? You know, I don't think it's healthy.
Look, I mean, that's a whole podcast just in itself. But where do we even begin to unpack this and unravel this? Because just a bit of a context, my little one's about to start school. We enrolled her in a wonderful local public school for kindergarten in 2023. And it's really got me thinking about this. It's got me thinking about sustainability, and it's got me thinking about the importance of retaining great teachers within classrooms. And I don't even know where to start with this. I mean, I'm incredibly passionate about what we get to do as educators. It's something which I'm sort of spoilt now, like I have to do it because I love it so much. But I don't know where we even start to unravel some of the challenges that we've had or that we've got. What are your thoughts on that? Because it almost seems too overwhelming to know where to even begin.
Well, I think it reminds me of the one of my favourite jokes. My parents used to tell me, one of the only jokes I can remember my parents telling me. They weren't great on jokes. They were great on values and things like that. But, you know, how do you eat an elephant? One part at a time. Which part do you eat? The bit that's in front of you. And I think for us as a profession to find the answers to the logjam that we've got at the moment, where we've got all the intent in the world, we've got the resources to do it, except the time and the energy, so the human capital that we need. Although I'm not sure that human capital is a term I want to use or align myself too much. I prefer the term social capital more than anything else. Or character capital. You know, if you go back and look at our research, you know, particularly, you know, that's what we talk about, the character capital that we've got. For us to do that, we have to unwind assumptions. As I alluded to earlier, the first assumption I would start with is, why do we need children to be in school for 7 hours a day? Why do we need that to happen?
Yeah.
You know, because there's no educational reason for it. You know, if you look around the world, this assumption that we've got that kids spending more time during the day at their schoolwork will lead to better performance by students in examination tasks, which is really, you know, if we're honest, that's the only measure that we've got any agreement on so far, even though that's the wrong measure for us to be relying on. But, you know, why? Why do we need children in school for that period of time? Why do we need children at school 5 days a week?
And the answer
is that that school has to fulfill a number of different social functions, one of which is child mining. So we need something to do with children while parents are working. And so what we do is we occupy as much time as possible of their time as possible at school. So while parents are working, so how do we make that work?
Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but especially in cities like Sydney and Melbourne, where one wage just isn't enough, we can't pay off a mortgage especially with one teacher's wage. So unfortunately, we are sort of forced to have two income earners.
Tell me about it. You know, I'm in my 50s. I've still got a mortgage. You know, because at the end of the day, you know, it's I'm not married anymore, but when I was, and when we were raising three children through it, you know, it's trying to make a living, trying to live in a city, trying to make things work in the way they do. I mean, you know, schools have been grappling with the reality. And I saw an article about it today, which is interesting, making the press for the first time around it. Where do teachers live? you know, because you've got to be able to afford a house and you want teachers to be in the community in which they're teaching. Well, the simple reality is that here in Melbourne, if you're a young family and you're just starting out and you've got young children and you're teaching, well, there's no way you're living in inner city Melbourne. You know, if you want, well, if you want the sort of
backyard and three bedrooms, it's just not going to happen.
Like, yeah, exactly. That's simply not going to happen around that. So it's, and you know, do we want teachers? Do we want children? Do we want anybody commuting for an hour to an hour and a half either end of the day? One thing that I've noticed that since we took the circle group online, so in 2015 we made the decision to transfer everything that we do to remote working, the people who work with us, there's 3 hours a day they don't spend in traffic. Now, you know, there are upsides and downsides, so you know there's some interesting things that we have to do around time zones because we've got different people working with us all around the world, so you know, trying to find times where we're all up and so on and so on, there are always compromises to be made. But you know, I don't miss commuting. I don't miss commuting at all. You know, there's, you know, I used to live when I'm a Sydney side, as you probably know, I'm a passionate Waratahs supporter. And you know, I love the New South Wales Blues cricket team and always have. But you know, I had, my house was in Strathfield, my office was in Crow's Nest, 11 kilometres, and that never took under an hour getting home of an evening. You'd sit there and go, what's the point of that?
You know, yeah, look, I mean, there's so much in that, isn't there, Phil? Like, I feel so fortunate because I mean, I love change. I mean, I've been criticised for many things in my career, and one of them is being annoyingly optimistic. And so I will take that. But I never in a million years thought that our profession would be one that went online, and yet it did. One day we were in schools, and then the other day we were awkwardly trying to navigate and control a classroom on Zoom and Microsoft Teams. And so it raises some really interesting questions about what the role of schools is, or what the role of schools are, and also the role of teachers. I mean, I miss being able to be at home with my kids and teaching my class. I don't know how efficient I was as a teacher, but we were back at school pretty quickly. I mean, now I know a lot of industries are having conversations about how do we get back into the office? How do we do this? How do we do that? We were told you're back in the office from Monday. And so we didn't have any choice.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting time. And there's nothing like a crisis, I think, to cause us to question everything. And so for that, I'm incredibly grateful for.
Absolutely. Yeah. And look, you know, it's one of the people who inspires me a lot is the Australian soldier and engineer and statesman, Sir John Monash. You know, it's, I'm like, you know, it's, The first part of his career was about inventing sewage systems that could change Melbourne. When you understand that the fundamentals of people's lives, that the role of leadership, the role of administration is actually to build the infrastructure that can allow people to live a life that's well lived and worthwhile.
Yeah, wow.
You know what I mean? It's like you. So most people would celebrate Monash for his remarkable capacity as a soldier, for being Vice Chancellor of Melbourne University, of various different other leadership roles later in his life. You know, he's the guy who built the sewage systems that meant that the inner city, the inner city no longer flooded with sewage every time the water table came up. You know, we've got to remember that to allow teachers to do what they do best, which is to build the character and competency and wellness of students so that they can thrive in the world today, we need to provide schools that are genuine, you know, communities of inquiry and practice. If we have teachers who are so stressed all the time that they're in flight or fright or fight mode, then they can't be the best versions of themselves. And if we teach who we are, and we're always presenting the worst version of ourselves to the kids, if we're always anxious, we're always stressed, we're always feeling as though that we don't have the time to stop and think creatively, then no wonder our kids will tell us that our classrooms are not necessarily creative places, that our teachers are always stressed, and that we feel like it's a never-ending hamster wheel of, you know, one bloody examination after another. At some point we have to stop this, and we have to say there is a better way. We need to connect with the purpose we have as educators
Yeah.
And then form practice on the basis of that. And as leaders in education, we need to create the conditions in which teachers and kids can grow through their learning together.
Yeah, absolutely. To change direction slightly, Phil, what are you most grateful for from your parents? You talked about values and also infrequent jokes, but is there anything else that you are grateful for to your parents or your upbringing?
I think my answer to this sort of question changes every time it gets asked. Because, you know, certainly the older you get, the more you sort of reflect who you are and how you got to where you got to. You know, the job of younger people is to separate themselves from their parents. The job of older people is to bring families together and to recognize and try and do what you can to cultivate the storylines. I think the first thing I'm very grateful for with my parents is the way in which they taught me to value education itself. It's a commonplace now in society that education is probably the answer to most of the challenges that we've got. I don't know that it always is, for example. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at rates of teenage smoking, education can get us only so far. But just because we educate kids about tobacco and nicotine doesn't stop a whole lot of kids from going out and vaping and doing the things that they do. So I think that it's a bit Pollyanna-ish to say that education solves everything, but education is probably the most powerful solution we've got to a lot of the challenges we've got in society. So I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing I'm grateful for my parents for is they taught me how to work bloody hard. I think, you know, for me, I think that's been a bedrock of the way in which I've been able to try and build my own approach to doing the things that I need to do. I don't pretend that I get everything right, but at least I'm not going to die wondering whether or not I gave it a go. I think there are plenty of other things I think I could be grateful for my parents about, but I'll give you a third one. I'll give you a third one because it's always good to go in rule of threes. I think my parents gave me a really good sense of story and of the importance of story. That's informed everything in my life, really, the need to find and tell a story.
Yeah, wow, that's really powerful. And Phil, just wondering, what were you like at school? And did you have a teacher that that made a difference in your life? It could be a positive difference or a negative one, unfortunately.
At school, I was the brightest kid at a school full of very, very bright kids.
Okay.
And I loved learning, and it was an absolute joy until I was around about 10. And then the more competitive, aggressive side of humanity became clearer. I was bullied pretty severely for about 3-4 years, so badly I changed schools. I went to a new school, and even though what happened at that school, you know, some of the teachers were great, some of them weren't. There was bullying there because it was the 1980s, and you know, that sort of thing happened more frequently in schools in those days. I just absolutely flourished in that environment. There are lots of teachers who made a real difference in my life. Most of them taught history. The one I want to give a real shout out to, David Thomas, who's still teaching now in his 70s. He's just stepping down as a housemaster at the school I went to, the second school I went to in high school, Cranbrook School, in Bellevue Hill in Sydney. And he's remarkable. He's a remarkable person. He has been teaching for over 50 years, still has a twinkle in his eye, and I'll be having dinner with him later this week. He inspires me every time I see him. He's now a friend and a colleague. We've written books together. There's so much of who I am as a teacher and as an historian is formed by him.
It's amazing, and even to see as a man in his 50s, it's great to see your eyes light up when you talk about your teacher, and it's a really beautiful reminder of the power that teachers have to really shape the lives of young people. I know I had a teacher that I had the privilege of interviewing on my podcast. It was Mrs. Taylor Jones in this little country town in the middle of the United Kingdom in a place called Belper, the kind of place that you would drive past, you would never stop at. And I remember my parents had separated at the time. And so I remember walking into her class. I had no idea what she taught me for that year, but I knew exactly how she made me feel. And I'm sure she did that to the 35 other kids in that class. But I had the privilege of having her on the podcast, and I was actually quite emotional. I went back and we did a family trip a number of years ago, and went back and saw her, and I just gave her a hug, and my wife turned around and said to me afterwards, "Yeah, that wasn't cool. You just hugged your teacher and mate." I said, "Yeah, but that's the power of what great educators do." And it's lovely to hear that you've got a relationship with your teacher.
Absolutely.
Just wondering, Phil, I mean, you seem like you got a lot on your plate. I mean, you've got a school for tomorrow. You've obviously done your doctorate, you're researching. It seems like you're speaking at every conference that's coming up. How on earth do you find the time to do a podcast? And why is that something which is so meaningful to you?
I do stuff because I do stuff. That's the best way to put it. It's who I am. I've always liked to be fully engaged, and I'd hate to finish my time and to have left undone things that should have been attended to.
It's that hard work kind of mentality you're talking about.
I think so. But also, it's fun. It's you've got to be creative. You've got to mix things up. You know, the last thing in the world I thought I'd ever end up as a professor at a university. You know, I didn't have the best time at university, but going back now and doing that as part of what I do has enabled us to do so much interesting stuff in the field of research and so on. Look, podcasting. So I was speaking at a conference in 2017. There's this De Prado character. You know, the big shock of silver hair. And Adriano and I didn't know each other very well at that point in time, but we'd been circling around each other at conferences all over the place. And we've got a really interesting take on things.
He's better than any triple shot cup of coffee. I had him on a little while ago.
And yeah.
I don't think he blinked once. He's amazing. I don't know how.
Look, he's just tremendous. Don't tell him I was paying him too many compliments, but he's just tremendous. Anyway, so we'd hang around an airport. Said let's go to the Virgin Club and have a coffee or a drink. And of course, he had a prosecco, and I might have had a glass of red. And we began talking. I said, got to do something together. Anyway, we conceived of a project, a leadership development program that we started to put in place at the final school he worked at in Marcelin College in Berlin. He finished up there at the end of 2019. He was having every intention of doing a sabbatical year. And I just kept ringing him and nagging him, because once I knew that he was free, I thought, I've got to get him in to do some stuff with us. You know, we're in our third, if you like, iteration of the circle group.
Yeah.
At that point in time, you know, we were thinking about, you know, we'd sort of built out this knowledge architecture of what it looks like to be an excellent school based on research and consulting. So theory and practice in schools all over the world. What are we going to do with this thing? But I just thought, you know what? I'm sick and tired of writing every week. I'm sick and tired of speaking at people in conferences. What would it be like to do a podcast? Anyway, eventually nagged him, dragged him out of his seclusion. We had a drink about 100 meters from where I'm sitting right now at Napier Quarter, said, "Let's do a podcast." And he said, "Only if we can hear other people." And I said, "Well, that's the point." Nice. Talking to and hearing other people. And we recorded our first one, I think, later that week. Wow. And we set out the provocation. We went on from there. We've been very intent about being low tech about what we do. There is no bells and whistles. we're more interested in the conversation, because at the end of the day, chalkies do stuff because they can see other people doing it. Most chalkies don't design from first principle. They iterate from a given model. Mm. So where are the role models around about the place? We just had a ball. We're just in the process of recording our 12th series around it. We've got a book from Hooker Brownlow Education, Game Changers, Leading Today's Learning for Tomorrow's World, which is coming out of that. And that's, again, based on both our theory and practice. Amazing. And also the Game Changers podcast. Man, it's just fun, isn't it? Like, this is way more fun than delivering a lecture. Right. And you reach a lot more people, and it's real. Like, you're talking to real people. Like, you know your stuff. You're in a classroom every day. I can get a lot more from conversation by podcasting than I can from any book, even the books that we've written. You know, there's a fantastic publication that's just been put out by the Jubilee Centre at the University of Birmingham, and they're probably the leading researcher institute into character education. Now, I don't necessarily agree with a lot of their precept, which is around taking the Aristotelian virtues and using them as the starting point. I tend to like building an image of character from the ground up in a community rather than imposing a model on it. That having been said, they're doing brilliant work. There's lots of research. They just put out a book on character education. There's a conference that we hosted with the Scots College and University of Notre Dame and the Relationships Foundation earlier this year. Dr. Hugh Chilton, who's one of my close colleagues at the Scots College, had this fantastic book summarising pretty much 10 years worth of their research. And we realised that out of the four of us, none of us had ever read any of that research.
Wow.
Now, we're the guys working with people around the world to do the character education stuff. Even we don't have access to the gap between the theory and the practice. There's a severe knowledge doing gap. It applies right throughout business in general and businesses in general, but particularly in education.
Amazing.
And I think part of it is because of the mode of delivery, that traditional university mode, which is about the cultivation and preservation of knowledge, acts as a wall that people who are at the chalk face, I mean, I bet you, if I said to you, how big is the pile of reading that you've set yourself? You know, it's up to the ceiling, isn't it? We don't have time to do the reading. We need ways to do it. And podcasting seems to be a great way. I listen to podcasts every day. I tend to wake up early. I've got 2 to 3 hours in the morning before I get up and do things. I listen to podcasts. And I learn so much more from listening to conversations between people than I do trying to sit down and read a book. If I sit down and try and read an academic book, I just end up going back to sleep.
Well, do you know what? One of the reasons why I started the podcast was after I started The Art of Teaching was after listening to Game Changers podcast. And I thought, wow, like, it's such a really interesting medium. And we talked about this before we hit record, but it's a really nice way, in my point of view, to be able to get the latest ideas from academics and experts such as yourself into the classroom, because there does seem to be that gap between research and practice. And so I love that there are people all over the world now that will get to listen to this conversation and this discussion, and that will impact the teaching and learning that's happening in their classrooms, and also that would impact the students who are in the classrooms. And so it's a wonderful medium. I still can't stand the sound of my own voice when I don't listen to them back. Terrifying. I don't know. Do you feel like that as well? Or are you sort of, do you sort of put it out there and hope for the best? Or what's your process with that?
So the first thing I'd say is, and I'm really glad that you're doing your podcast, The Art of Teaching, because that way you might actually get it right. Because the Prado and I, geez, we still get it wrong all the time. But I really struggle with listening to the sound of my own voice. I force myself to do it. Adriano is assiduous around sort of listening to everything that we do and making sure it's this and that and the other and so on and so on. I'm less assiduous about it. I will listen to everything that we do eventually.
Yeah.
I tend to read the transcripts more than go and listen to what I have said, you know. Every now and then, though, there's a guest. I mean, it's, you know, who will compel me because of who they are. Mm. You know, it's, listen, you know, Brian, I had the opportunity to talk with Bryony Scott in a special series, and she's just remarkable. I'd listen to it in the shower, and then, you know, while I'm sort of doing the housework on a Saturday morning or something like that, I try not to listen to myself and I try and focus on the guest.
Yeah, nice one. I think you guys are, the work that you're doing is hugely inspiring. And I'm just interested, Phil, tell me about A School for Tomorrow. Why, I can see in your background, you have the wonderful logo there, but why do we need to have these discussions? It may sound like an obvious question, but why is it a project that you care so deeply about?
Sure. Let me tell you a little bit about the history of this. So I started teaching in 1988 part-time while I was still studying, which I know would horrify some people, but, you know, Western civilization didn't collapse because I was a trainee teacher doing some teaching and sort of eventually got into it full-time.
That was my first year in kindergarten.
I mentioned David Thomas. I should mention Helen Carmody as well too. She was a kindergarten teacher at my school who taught me an awful lot about teaching, because if you can teach kindergarten, you can tell a story to the kinder kids, you can make anything work in a school.
I couldn't agree more.
There it is. So after about 20 years, so after 2008, and I was running a school, and I fell out of love with it, and it's all I'd ever wanted to do, and I suddenly knew that I didn't want to do this thing anymore. What I did know is that I wanted to work with more than just one school, but with schools all over the place. So I had an opportunity to spend a year and a half working for Dr. Ian Lambert at Scots College in Sydney as his executive officer, and while I was doing that, formulated the idea for a McKinsey's in education. In other words, a research-based organisation that helped build better outcomes for more learners. And I acquired a company called Creative School Management that had been around for 25 years. At that point, I was the third owner of it. But I didn't want to do it simply on the basis of the Phil Cummins I Reckon School. I wanted to build up a knowledge archive, a knowledge architecture around building solutions that you could take from one place to another, and it wasn't just based on my opinion. So we formed a team and built out CIRCLE, which is the Centre for Innovation, Research, Creativity and Leadership in Education, which of course spells CIRCLE, which is the sort of thing you come up with as a teacher when you're bored on a Thursday afternoon in an executive meeting. You come up with a silly anagram, don't you? Anyway, so for about... For 10 years or so, we had that in play, did major research projects around the world, formed a view that there was an intersection between an education for character and the character of an excellent education. But it's schools we went to all around the world. And it's about schools for me. We work from chalk face to chalk face to chalk face. I admire and respect the work that people like Tony Mackay, and others do at a sort of a global policy level. But for me, you know, if I want to influence outcomes for your kids in your school, I'll come and work with your school, you know. So we sort of went from school to school to school. We built up this knowledge architecture. We sort of worked out what it means to do an education for character and the character of an excellent education, these sort of six corridors of culture and leadership and learning and performance, strategy and systems and operations that you can use to look at any school, the right questions to ask around it. But then we're sitting there going, oh, it's time now that we have a front face of this that provides the output of all of our learning in a series of tools that people can use. And I can remember a conversation with Adriano and Oliver, my son Oliver, who has been our producer and is now working with in our organisation, helping to do our next major project, which is Voyage, which is a digital platform for global students everywhere to find all the things that they need in one place. We sort of said what we really interested in is helping build a school for tomorrow, that inherently schools that are caught in a story about yesterday or a story about today miss the point that the story is a story of yesterday and today and tomorrow. We need to honor the past. We need to attend to the present, but we need to be moving towards the future. And that future, as we worked out since, it needs to be human-centered. It needs to be people and place and planet conscious. It needs to be technologically enriched, and it needs to be intentionally purposeful about what it does. And that purpose has to be linked to helping students to thrive in their world. Mm-hmm. There's stuff in there about adaptive expertise and self-efficacy, which are sort of two vehicles about moving towards the future that sort of sit within there. There's graduate outcomes that we when we talk with people all over the world, they tell us who they want their students to, their children to be and to become. They want them to be good people. They want them to be future builders. They want them to be continuous learners and unlearners. They want them to be solution architects, to be responsible citizens, and they want them to be team creators. So how do you build a set of tools around all of this and provide them to people as best you can? That's what the School for Tomorrow is. Wow. It's a global network that works with students and teachers and leaders and school teams to help them to think about what it takes to thrive and how to take that big step forward and up together.
Wow. There's so much in that, Phil, and I think something which has come up throughout our interview, it seems to be a bit of a thread, is that notion of story. I mean, you talked about with your parents, that's one of the things that you're grateful for, to be able to tell a great story. I'm thinking of sort of the narrative of history, kind of like where we've come from, how do we honour the past, how do we plan and prepare for the future, and it seems to be something which is absolutely central to a school for tomorrow. Is that the case? Is that something? Why is that so important to you guys?
Well, I think it's not because it's important to us. I think it's because it's the fundamental way that human beings make sense of the world,
yeah,
and of the universe around them, is that they tell stories.
Yeah.
And if you can't tell, if you can't tell a good story, how are you going to help somebody connect with their own sense of humanity, their own inner drive, and then how are you going to help them wrestle,
yeah,
with everything around them? You know, it's every tradition, every community, every society has stories. We tell, as human beings, we tell stories to each other. It's buried deep within our DNA. If you want to turn kids on in a classroom, tell them a story.
Yeah.
You know that. You know, if you want to turn kids off, take the story out of it.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think that's so important. Like I love the process of going on a journey with a story. I love the story arc. I love the purpose within the story, and it's really interesting to hear how you guys do that with a School for Tomorrow, and also why that's so central. And Phil, I'm just wondering, what does it's a terrible word to use when talking about education, but what does success look like with a School for Tomorrow? What are some of the ways that you know that you've been making a difference?
Oh, look, I'll take exception there. I think success is a really, really important term to define, because it's the Matthew principle, isn't it? To those who have, more will be given, and to those who don't, true. You know. I said earlier that I think that story is hardwired into our DNA, so is success. We need to feel successful. We need to feel as though we're getting somewhere. We need to balance out an understanding of success by saying that there has to be a foundation of well-being that sits under everything, a foundation of wellness, probably more than just well-being, because well-being is part of wellness. You know, it's about feeling well, but you also have to actually be well at the same time. So there's got to be a foundation of wellness. There's got to be a foundation of character, and character is how we live our lives. It's about belonging. So it's about the civic character of belonging. It's about the performance character of fulfilling your potential. It's about the moral character of doing what's good and right. You need all three of those, but there's a sequence to them. You know, if you feel as though you belong, you're more likely to achieve your potential. If you feel as though you belong and achieve your potential, then you're more likely to do good and right in the world. Now, that's three very different types of success.
Yeah.
And they're measured in three very different types of ways. And the agency in all three of them differs as well too. So with belonging, you can't determine that you belong in an organisation or a community. The community has to vote you into the tribe.
Yeah.
And there's usually a threshold test that they apply in relation to that. Once you are in to a group and you feel as though you belong, then to achieve your potential, that's more about, much more about a continuum. And the agency within that sits with you and your teachers or your coaches. And we would call that character apprenticeship. That's what David Thomas taught me. He's been teaching me all my life. He teaches through who he is. He models, he scaffolds, he coaches. And gradually over time, as I get expertise, I get more agency, and he steps out of the scene and allows me to go on and do that in its own right. The third piece, which is about the moral character piece, I have complete agency over that. I form a moral code about what I think is good and right in the world. And although you can suggest to me whether or not I'm aiming up enough, all you can really do is hold up a mirror to me and say, look, this is what you said you'd do. Have you actually done that in and around it? It's very cheeky of you to tell me that I'm doing something wrong, but it's far more helpful to turn around and say, well, you said this is what you were going to do. Are you actually doing that? Is there a congruity to it? Is there an integrity to it? So I think those, and that's about the drive towards yourself. I think the second measure of success, I mentioned those graduate outcomes earlier. That's about social expectations. I think there is a third measure, and it's simply a reality. I grumble about exams, but exams are the system that we have that allows entry into the next level. So things like exams, like results matter. Like, you know, I told you earlier, you know, I'm a mad keen Waratah supporter. There's always a scoreboard in life. And when the Waratahs win on the weekend, I feel happier. Don't you?
I do. You know? I do.
You know? Yeah. Don't tell me that being in a team and losing feels good, because it doesn't feel good. It just makes you want to win more. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think there's a balancing act between all of those sorts of things in and around that. What I want to see is I want to see more kids and families who feel as though they belong are achieving their potential and are doing good and right in the world. There are a variety of different measures that we can use to do that, some of which are external to a community, others of which are internal to a community, some of which you measure yourself. We've got an app called Voyage. You can get it on, you know, the Apple store and the Android store, where you can measure yourself in terms of your own character development and set your own measures up in relation to that. But at the end of the day, you can't just measure yourself. You can't, you know, others will measure you. I worry about schools which take competition out and just focus on cooperation, because it's a little bit like, you know, it's a little bit like having salt without pepper. You know, cooperation and competition are natural and normal states of human being.
Yeah.
It's part of who we are. It's when we get them out of balance with each other that things go wrong. I remember a story Mum told me about when we were kids, my brother and I, and, you know, she tried to keep all the guns out of the house because it was the 1970s and, you know, it was all peace, love and mung beans and stop the war and stop the bomb and all of that sort of stuff was going on. And so there were no little plastic guns for us to play cowboys and Indians with. So when we were out in the backyard, we'd just grab sticks and pretend those were guns and paddle pop sticks and things like that. And in the end, Mum just gave up because she said, look, it's in the nature around that. It's better to teach people how to utilize best the gifts and talents that they've got rather than to punish them for being who they are or deny them an essential part of their humanity.
Mm.
I don't know. That's another very long rambling answer.
Yeah, no, I think there's so much in there, Phil, and I think so many of your answers that sort of warrant a whole podcast series in themselves.
No, that'd be terrible. You got way more interesting people to talk to.
Look, it's really interesting, and I obviously want to be respectful of your time, so just a couple of closing questions. Let's just imagine we're sitting down having a coffee and I'm about to step into the classroom for the first time. I'm bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I've got my teaching number and I'm ready to go. What would that conversation be like? And what advice would you give me as I'm about to embark on this journey?
Relationships and values are more important than anything else.
Yeah.
Anything else that you will do in education. That would be the starting point.
Yeah.
Secondly, you will make lots of mistakes. Thirdly, don't take yourself seriously. And learn how to laugh at yourself, particularly in front of kids. I think most of the time when teachers get things wrong with what we call behavior management, and don't even get me started about appointing a chief behavior officer. But what we get wrong most about classroom management is when we take ourselves too seriously and we get proud and we get pinged for something that we've done wrong instead of just laughing it off.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a whole lot easier for me to walk into any educational space now, whether I'm working with kids or with adults. You know, I've got 30-odd years sitting behind me of laughing at myself. And you know, my memories are never about of teaching and never about the things that I've done well. I always remember the things I messed up. I always remember the things that I got wrong. And those are the things that play inside all the time, saying, don't stuff it up. Don't get this wrong again. You know, learn from your mistakes. So I think I'd start around that. I think the conversation would then get onto a conversation about mastering your content. Like, and I know this is terribly old-fashioned stuff, but if you're a history teacher and you don't know the history that you're supposed to be teaching, no one's going to respect you.
Yeah.
All right, so you've got to know your stuff, and then delight in when the kids know it better than you. You know, and then the final thing, have a plan for everything you do, but the first casualty of war is the plan. So be prepared to throw it out the window when you need to, especially when it's a hot, windy Thursday afternoon in December in Sydney and the humidity is about 150%.
And Phil, would that be similar advice if I was sitting down having a coffee with you as a someone who is about to become a school principal or a school leader? Is there anything else you would add to that?
Yeah, I think the thing that I would add to that is that the expertise that you gain as a leader grows exponentially in terms of both accomplishment and challenge as you get older and you get more experienced in the role. So the things that you are challenging and complex in your first 5 years, they should be your bread and butter after 5 years, and then you go on to take on more complex and challenging things after that. So the idea that there's this sort of fixed body of stuff you do and somehow it will get easier, it's just a nonsense. If that's your attitude, you shouldn't be doing it, because you need to keep growing all the time. Second thing I would say to a principal is never stop teaching. Even if you only teach one lesson a week, even if your classroom is an assembly hall, never stop teaching. I've never stopped teaching, no matter what it is that I do. I always do a little bit of teaching. Because it's the great leveler, isn't it? It's, you can get very carried away with the wonderfulness of being yourself. The third thing is that if there is such a thing as legacy, it's the lives of other people. You know, if you're lucky, they'll name a classroom block after you. If you're unlucky, they'll name a toilet block after you. But at the end of the day, all buildings will get knocked down. The only thing that matters is the impact you have on the lives of other people. And whether or not you can say, in all honesty, that you had a better impact on more lives than a worse impact. That's all that really matters.
Fantastic. And Phil, we talked a lot about story. It's kind of, as I mentioned, been sort of woven in and out of our discussion today. What do you want, looking back at the end of your career in education, what do you want your story to have been? What sort of impact do you want to have had on other people?
Oh, I'm going to duck that one and say that's up to other people to determine. I've got more years to come and more things Fantastic. That I want us to be able to do. I don't know. You'll probably be around when I'm gone. So you and the other people can work it out for yourselves at that point. I'm more interested in how it is that we can help more. I'm just more interested in how we can help people find their sense of purpose and align their practice with it. You know, that's really what I want to be able to do more and more and more and more and more. So, I don't know.
Fantastic. I don't think that's a dodge at all. I think that really encapsulates so much of our discussion, which is actually about service to other people and making a difference and making an impact in the lives of others. So I think that is that's a wonderful answer. And Phil, finally, where can we find out more about you?
aschoolfortomorrow.com is the best place to find us. Of course, the Game Changers podcast available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts,
it's SoundCloud. It's my second favorite podcast. It's great. Yeah,
There we go. They're probably good places to find on our stuff. If you're an Instagram person, you can go and read my poems on there, and then throw fruit at me.
Amazing. Well, I'll make sure I put all of the resources that we've talked about, all of the links to the work that you're doing, and also some of the books that we've mentioned in the show notes. But Phil, I can't thank you enough for your time. It's a huge privilege to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Matthew, thank you. God bless you for the work you're doing as well too. It's so, so, so important that we have this network of the curious and the willing and the motivated who are ready to take that big step up and forward together. Your work is inspiring, and I appreciate what you're doing. I appreciate you having me on today. Thank you very much.
Amazing. Thanks so much.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Art of Teaching podcast today. I hope that you, like me, got some valuable insights out of our discussions. For show notes, please visit theartofteachingpodcast.com. And I've also created a private Facebook group where we can continue the discussion there. The link will be in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and can't wait to see you for next week's episode.